From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Halloween edition of Fresh Air, Dracula in movies, books, folklore, and bebop.
We're going out tonight to break some things. We've dined on lemonade and pigeon's wings. We'll set your shoes on fire and then your hair. We're kind of ugly, but we don't care. Mrs. Brown is in the flat below. All our attentions we do bestow. The kind of neighbors that do things right. We'll bumble her with all our might. Scooby-Dooby-Dooby. And we're proud of it.
First the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. The United Nations Security Council is weighing consequences today for Iraq. Baghdad has ratcheted up its challenge to the United Nations by barring two Americans from the UN Weapons Inspection Team from entering Iraq. The UN Security Council is warning Iraq of serious consequences if the ban is not withdrawn. But Iraqi President Saddam Hussein says he won't change his mind, even if it provokes military action. The Security Council dispatched weapons inspectors to Iraq after the Gulf War to make sure Baghdad destroyed all its weapons of mass destruction. British au pair Louise Woodward was sentenced today to a mandatory life in prison sentence with no chance of parole for 15 years. A jury found her guilty last night of second-degree murder for abusing the baby that she was hired to care for. NPR's Tovia Smith reports.
Just before sentencing, Matthew Eapen's parents read an emotional address to the court, saying they've suffered excruciating pain since their 8-month-old baby was rushed to the hospital in a fatal coma February 4th, and police accused their au pair of shaking him to death. Dr. Deborah Eapen is Matthew's mother.
I'm sickened to think he was crying for help and was instead beaten by hands that were supposed to be caring for him. She didn't look scary to me. She didn't seem like a child abuser or a monster or a murderer.
Louise Woodward also addressed the court, insisting, quote, I would never have hurt Maddie. I never did hurt Maddie. I don't know what happened to him, she said. I'm not responsible for his death. Woodward's attorneys are asking the court to throw out the guilty verdict and order a new trial. They're also asking the judge to reduce the charge from murder to manslaughter. Tovia Smith, NPR News, Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Today is the deadline for the former warring factions in Bosnia to make drastic cuts in their armed forces. This is in keeping with the Dayton Peace Accords. The reduction is seen as critical to the region's future stability. The BBC's Mark Laity reports.
The destruction of huge amounts of weapons will be seen as a significant success for the international community, which in other respects has been getting increasingly frustrated at its continuing problems in achieving permanent peace. During the war, the Bosnian Serbs' heavy weapons gave them a big advantage over the Muslims and Croats. But under the arms control agreement, the Muslim Croat Federation will have twice the equipment of the Serbs. The aim, though, is to produce a balance of power, with overall cuts that leave each side having only enough for self-defense. There's confidence both sides will meet the deadline. The worry of some NATO commanders now is that the balance of power may be upset because the once powerful Serb armies are becoming increasingly ramshackle, while the Muslim Croat forces are, under an American scheme, being trained and re-equipped with modern weapons and appear more capable of winning any future conflict.
Mark Laity reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow's up nearly 16 points at 73.97. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has had another day of volatile trading. Bloomberg's Doug Krusner reports from New York.
The market has been buffeted by conflicting signals on the economy. The increase in third quarter economic growth was stronger than expected, though inflation remained in check. On the other hand, manufacturing in the Midwest slowed during October, but the region saw higher raw material prices. These reports have done little to clarify the outlook for interest rates. Even so, investors remain focused on the behavior of the global stock markets. Overnight, the Asian markets gained after Indonesia received a pledge from the International Monetary Fund for $23 billion in standby assistance. In exchange, Indonesia pledged to restructure its financial sector and complete other economic reforms. I'm Doug Krisner.
Investors in physician management companies Ficor and MedPartners forced shares of both firms lower today. Investors are worried about the announced merger between the two companies. The sell-off has cut the value of the proposed deal from $7 billion to a little more than $5.5 billion. One investment house says FICOR is paying too high a price to buy Med Partners. Another says the merger will increase FICOR's risk and cut its growth. Ford is recalling nearly 750,000 Windstar minivans and Mustang sports cars. The automaker is responding to complaints that the top panel of the vehicle's hood can break and fly off while motorists are driving. Sometimes the hood hits the windshield. The recall affects Windstars made in 1995 and 96 and Mustangs produced between 1994 and 1996. I'm Corva Coleman, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 170 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I am Dracula. I bid you welcome. Listen to them. Children of the night. What music they make.
On this archive edition, in the spirit of Halloween, we've brought garlic into the Fresh Air Crypt to scare out the vampire interviews, which we will present to you today. David Scall is an expert on vampires and horror films. He's co-editor of the 100th anniversary edition of Dracula, which reprints Bram Stoker's novel along with reviews and essays. Scall is also the author of Hollywood Gothic, The Monster Show, and Dark Carnival, a biography of Todd Browning, who directed the Bela Lugosi version of Dracula. Last year, I asked Scall why he thinks we're so captivated by the idea of vampires.
Well, there hasn't been a human civilization in recorded history that has not had some variation on the theme of the vampire. And our reasons for reviving the vampire theme over and over again in literature and popular culture over the centuries have, there are many different reasons, I think. In our current age, I think it is rather obvious that this huge vampire renaissance in the last 10 years has had everything to do with the parallel AIDS epidemic and our cultural fixation on frightening themes having to do with blood and blood contact. And I think Anne Rice, of course, whose novels are very much one of the driving engines of this vampire revival, is aware of this consciously. And she's played with the metaphor of the vampire as disease. She started writing her vampire chronicles following the death of her young daughter from a blood disease, leukemia. But I think she's also spoken very eloquently about the metaphor she sees connected to the AIDS epidemic, the idea of the vampire as a kind of a symbol for an alternate, supernaturalized kind of sexuality.
Let's look at Dracula, the 1931 Bela Lugosi version, the first American vampire film. Whose idea was it to make the film?
Well, all the studios in Hollywood were interested in the idea of doing Dracula as a film, but in the American film tradition, there were terrifying characters and creatures in the 1920s, but there were no supernatural monsters. If there was a haunting or a horrible character, it would always have to be explained away as the result of a human agency, you know, usually criminal, somebody trying to steal an inheritance or embezzle a fortune. And this is very unlike the European tradition, where the irrational and the fantastic were really part of the European filmmaking tradition from the very beginning, especially in Germany, where we had the prototype horror films like The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari and Nosferatu. But in America, it was just assumed that the public would not accept these bizarre stories. So even though Dracula as a stage play was making a lot of money, the studios took a long time deciding to whether or not it was worth the gamble. And it was considered a gamble.
Now, how did Bela Lugosi get the part? He had been in the stage version, yes, of Dracula?
Yes. Bela Lugosi came to America as a political expatriate from Hungary in the early 1920s, and where he was very active in the stage, was a member of the National Theater in Budapest, but got on the wrong side of the revolution. So he ended up here in New York playing all kinds of roles, most of them exotic heavies and foreigners. He learned his roles phonetically because he really never mastered English the way he should, one syllable at a time, which, you know, accounts for that amazing and deliberate manner of speaking that we forever associate with Dracula. But he first played Dracula in 1927 on the Broadway stage.
Bela Lugosi gave a performance that has left an indelible mark on the American imagination. What do you think works so well about his performance of Dracula?
Lugosi's performance kind of sums up the entire history of vampire impersonations in the theater and on film. Stoker's Dracula was nothing like the character Lugosi plays, except that he was certainly evil, but he was a horrible old man who got younger as he drank blood. He never really became attractive and was really a largely offstage presence throughout the book. When they did Dracula on the stage, they had to clean up the character because to follow the conventions of a drawing room mystery melodrama, which is how it had to be produced, Dracula had to be rethought as the kind of character you'd plausibly invite into a drawing room. And that's where we got the evening clothes and the slicked back hair and the unctuous Transylvanian charm. But with Lugosi, we see both the charmer, the Valentino-like lover from beyond the grave, but also that hint of pure evil. There's nothing sympathetic about Lugosi. He can charm, but just look at those eyes.
The studio that produced Dracula was concerned about homoerotic overtones in the story. What kind of communication did they have with the writer and director about that?
There were some very interesting annotations on Carl Laemmle Jr.'s script. Carl Laemmle Jr. was the producer of Dracula, the son of Carl Laemmle Sr., who inherited the reins of the studio at the age of 21 as a birthday present. And he was very concerned that Dracula was attacking not only women, but some of the sailors on the ship that took him to England, and of course Renfield, the solicitor who comes to his castle. And he wrote frantically in the margins, you know, Dracula should only go for women and not men. But Browning seemed to ignore this bit of advice, so we do have an aspect of a homoerotic seduction in that scene where Dracula invites Renfield up to his quarters in his castle, and the sexual undercurrents of Dracula have been the subject of a lot of very interesting criticism, mostly in the last 20 years or so, and especially the homoerotic aspects.
Now, the director of Dracula, Todd Browning, he has a little vocal cameo in Dracula, where he's the harbor master who goes aboard the ship that had brought Dracula to his castle. And looking in the shadows, we see the crazy Renfield, who has this unearthly laugh. Well, you got it perfect.
Well, I've seen the movie more times than I have to, than I really should admit, but...
You got it perfect. But as perfect as it is, I'm going to play the clip from the film so we get to hear the laugh and also the voice of the director, Todd Browning.
They must have come through a terrible storm. What's that? Why, come from that hatchway. Why, he's mad. Look at his eyes. Why, the man's gone crazy.
That's the voice of Todd Browning from his film Dracula. A really interesting sidebar of Dracula is that after that movie was made, there was a Spanish language version of the same movie. Why did they do it? How did they do it?
In the days of the early talkies, half of Hollywood's revenues were coming from the foreign market. And the appeal and novelty of these films was the chance to see actors speaking in their natural voices. So there was great resistance initially to the idea of dubbing films. So for a period of several years, when Hollywood was the only place in the world making sound pictures, simultaneous foreign language renditions were done of the films, not just the soundtracks, but the entire films. They'd be done with different casts, different directors, different photographers. And the Spanish language version of Dracula that was made at night on the same sets as the Browning film was one of the most ambitious. They had an actor, a Spanish actor named Carlos Villarías, play Dracula. He was the only actor who was allowed to watch the rushes because they wanted him to imitate Lugosi as closely as possible.
Wait, so was he supposed to give a Spanish version of an Eastern European accent?
That's an interesting point. One of the reasons these films didn't last all that much longer is that Spanish-speaking audiences around the world were annoyed that Hollywood would just throw together every kind of Spanish accent into one picture. So you'd have actors from Argentina, from Mexico, from Spain, with the clash of all the different accents. To my ear, he sounds pretty Castilian. Whether he was trying to sound like Lugosi is another matter. He did wear the same hairpiece as Lugosi in the film, the identical number. So it really never got a rest. It came off Lugosi's head at dusk and went on Carlos's head until dawn.
Did Dracula start a horror craze in the movies?
Oh, yes. It was a surprise to Universal. They didn't know what to expect. And it ended up saving the studio from bankruptcy. Universal was tottering on the edge of insolvency, as were many of the studios. I mean, this is still in the wake of the stock market crash, of course, in 1930 when the film was filmed. But immediately they rushed into production Frankenstein. Lugosi turned down the part of the monster, something he regretted for the rest of his career, because, of course, he made Boris Karloff a star.
Did Boris Karloff want the part? He was typed as Mummies and Monsters for years afterwards. Or he was doing something in the laboratory.
Yes. Unlike Lugosi, Karloff had a much more prosperous career playing monsters. I mean, he was struggling. He appeared in something like 80 films before he made Frankenstein as a bit player and doing character parts. Played a lot of gangsters and things like that. And Frankenstein put him on the map. And he really had no professional difficulties for the rest of his life. He made a lot of money. He managed his career very wisely and was always expressed gratitude, you know, to the monster. Never complained about being typecasting. Oh, he didn't like the word horror movie. He liked to call them terror films. Lugosi, on the other hand, with Dracula, which was his first big break in Hollywood, it was also the beginning of the end of his career. Because audiences never really accepted him in perhaps if he had worn some transforming makeup or something in Dracula, he would have had more versatility. But Dracula's face was Lugosi's. The voice of Dracula was Lugosi's. And he really couldn't escape it. In fact, he was buried in makeup and costume as Dracula when he died in 1956. I think it's the only time in theatrical history I know of that a character actor was so identified with a part that he went to the grave in costume.
Did he ask to be buried that way?
I
hope he wanted it. It would be pretty miserable if he didn't want that.
Apparently he did mention, it was not in his will, as was reported in the newspapers, but apparently he did mention the wish to friends and the family decided to do this. It's a very poignant act.
David Skahl is the author of Hollywood Gothic and The Monster Show. He co-edited the 100th anniversary edition of Dracula. Coming up, the star of zillions of vampire movies, Christopher Lee. This is Fresh Air.
Mr. Harker, I'm glad that you've arrived safely.
Count Dracula.
I am Dracula, and I welcome you to my house.
Many horror movie fans say that Christopher Lee created the definitive Dracula. Lee is perhaps the only actor who played Dracula, Frankenstein's monster, and the mummy. He was the star of the British horror films made by the Hammer Studio in the 50s and 60s. These movies were credited with reviving the horror genre and with helping to revive England's movie industry. Lee has made over 150 films, including The Curse of Frankenstein, The Horror of Dracula, Dracula Has Risen from the Grave, The Mummy, Dr. Terror's House of Horrors, and The Wicker Man. In 1990, I asked Christopher Lee to describe his vision of Dracula.
I never thought of him as a vampire, ever. I mean, the blood is the life. That's one thing you have to bear in mind. And it is for all of us, isn't it? Here is a man who is immortal. Here is a man who, through being immortal, is a lost soul. Here is a man who experiences the loneliness of evil, something he can't control, who wants to die. But there is a force in him, a malefic force, which drives him to do these terrible things. The character is heroic, based on the real man, a war leader and a national hero, I may say, in Romania to this day. Vlad the Impaler, certainly a bloodthirsty character, without a doubt. The character is romantic, so he is, as far as women are concerned, and erotic, and there's, of course, the obvious association with the bite, in a sexual sense, if you like. So I tried to put all those particular characteristics into the character. It appears that I succeeded, even with some of the material, and even when I didn't say anything.
Wasn't there one film where you thought that the lines were so bad that you refused to read any of the dialogue?
There was a second one.
That was the second one?
Yes, The Prince of Darkness. I read the script and I said, I won't say anything in this picture. I cannot possibly say these lines. They're not only unsayable, but they'll have everybody rolling about for the wrong reasons. This is the difficulty, of course, about making a film of this kind. You're treading such a very, very narrow line between credibility and absurdity. If you slip on the wrong side, you've lost the audience and the picture's dead. And consequently, when I read this dialogue and read this script, I said to them, oh, come on, you know, I'm not going to say any of these lines. Can you imagine somebody in front of a camera actually saying, I am the apocalypse? Now, unless you're making a religious picture or a picture like The Exorcist, this would sound ridiculous.
Well, was there a friction on the set between the people who had a more campy approach to the movies and the people who were really more serious about it, and the people who were hacks and the people who really had a vision?
I don't think anybody had a campy approach. I think we all took our work seriously when we came actually to shoot it. That doesn't mean to say that we didn't have a lot of laughs during the rehearsals and sometimes indeed during the shots when something went wrong. Obviously, we did have a lot of laughs. I frequently plunged past the camera with my contact lenses in because I was almost blind and couldn't see the person I was supposed to grab or assault or whatever it was. And there was an occasion when I had to pick a girl up off the ground and charge across this open space and throw her into a grave. And in one take, I succeeded in doing that. It's rather difficult picking somebody straight up off the ground, rather like being a weightlifter. And I tottered on the edge of this grave and fell straight in on top of her. So, of course, one had a lot of very amusing incidents, but if anybody regards those pictures as camp, I think they're doing a disservice to the very experienced professional people involved.
I agree. You've made films in many different countries, and you once said that every country has a different image of who you are as an actor and what kind of roles you
play people,
best.
The people, yes.
Yeah. Can you give us a sense of how you're regarded in different countries you've worked in?
Well, obviously in the more primitive countries, I'm not going to name them, where people have more primitive beliefs in any kind of gothic type of picture, they are very close to believing what they see, and sometimes they are actually afraid of approaching me, or where. I don't think that's the case anymore. I've had people making the sign of the evil eye against me in Spain, for instance, in remote villages and places like that, and taking their children off the streets as I walked down the road.
Christopher Lee, recorded in 1990. Here's Lenny Bruce on Enchanting Transylvania.
All the pictures used to motivate from Transylvania, and Boris Karloff narrates them. Well, Oh, Baylor, Baylor, do you realize we haven't had a gig in 6 months? I don't know what it is, but we could work the Vegas, the loungers, better than the goofers, you know? I don't know what's coming of the industry. But soon, the train will break down, and Baylor will be walking up looking for lodgings for the night. And we hear the knock on the door and the woman answering. Mm-hmm. Who are you? I've never seen you before. You're a stranger in Transylvania. What is your name? Who are you?
Permit me to intrude my tale. My name is Count Dracula.
Oh, you sound pretty wild. Come in, come in, come in. This town is the squarest. No one's come through here that's been far out for years.
Myself, my family are looking for lodgings for the night. And we don't want to be disturbed. Here's 10 years' rent in advance. Leave me alone. That's all. We want the room. Call it split. All right. Now I will take my family out of the boxes.
Oh, Papa, 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 it's so good to be out of the box. Papa, Papa.
Shut up and drink your blood. Bite Mama goodnight.
I can't stand to look at you. You.
But I don't bug me.
Don't give me bug me while the hip talk. Dopey bebopper you.
Get off my back. I beat the trip, the bus. We lost the arrangements, everything. You know, leave me alone. Will you? One time, leave me alone.
Sure, look at you. Supposed to be fancy then, handsome with the Vaseline on the hair. Dirting up all the pillowcases. I can't stand to look at you, pimp you. Ech, 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 ech. You're so low.
All right, all right. I'm trying to bring home a little bread. All you want from me, all right, so I don't play jazz. I'm not a swinger. I try, I'm trying, I'm trying. I'm not a bebop, but what do you want from me? I know I've got it. Music business keeps changing, that's what it is. Sure. That Russ Morgan took all my key men. That's what it is. You can only get a good rhythm section.
It is getting light out. I'm getting weak. Excuse me, madam.
Lenny Bruce, recorded in San Francisco in 1958. More vampires in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, historian Raymond McNally traces the Dracula legend to the sadistic 15th century Romanian prince Vlad Dracula. TV critic David Bianculli previews NBC's newest show, and we remember film director Samuel Fuller. He died yesterday.
We'll be right back.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we're celebrating Halloween by paying tribute to vampires. It is, after all, the year of the vampire. It's the 150th birthday of Bram Stoker and the centenary of the publication of his novel, Dracula. Raymond McNally is celebrating with a Stoker Undead Conference November 8th and 9th at Boston College, where he teaches. McNally is the author of several books about the history of vampire legends, and he's president of the International Dracula Society. He discovered the original Castle Dracula while traveling through Transylvania in 1967 on a Fulbright research grant. McNally discovered that Bram Stoker named the vampire in his classic novel Dracula after the 15th century Romanian prince Vlad Dracula. The prince wasn't a vampire, but he terrorized his subjects by punishing his transgressors with impalement on wooden stakes, which is why he was also known as Vlad the Impaler. I spoke with Raymond McNally in 1984, and he told me about Vlad's cruel and sadistic reign.
Well, he lived from 1431 to 1476, and the time period was when the Turks were moving up through the Balkans, a very turbulent period. And it was a very cruel period, too, in which he lived. As a child, he was given as a hostage to the Turks by his own father on the promise that the father, who was named Dracul, would not go to war with the Turks. And what did the father do? Father turned right around and went to war with the Turks, while his own son was held there hostage. Now, my assumption on that is, look, if I was left by my own father among these Turks as a hostage, and I hear my dear old dad has gone to war violating the treaty, thereby putting my life in jeopardy, I think life is pretty cheap as a teenager, if that's the way your own father treats you. So it was a rough time. Then when he came to the throne, his brother had been buried alive by the gentry, the boyars, and his father had been assassinated. It's a rough time. So it's no wonder he took vengeance initially. But then he pushed it far beyond that. He was, frankly, a sadistic kind of cruel person.
Can you describe a little bit the torture that he became known for?
Well, impaling is, of course, a lost art, fortunately, for most of us. It's the classic way of impaling is to take the victim, tie one horse to one leg, one horse to the other leg. The victim is on the ground. Take a stake or pole, oiled, rounded at the end. That's important so it won't pierce your innards. It's inserted in you. Slowly the horses move forward and you're hoisted up on it and you die slowly from exposure to the elements. Very cruel way and slow way to die.
Okay, this Vlad the Impaler, also known as Dracula, was terribly sadistic, but he wasn't a vampire.
No, he wasn't. His story, you know, he was a horror figure, basically, real horror, and his story was very, very popular in the late 15th century in Leningrad. I looked at this manuscript which talks about him in Russia. This manuscript was made in several copies. It's well known. And then there were some German stories about him in manuscript written by monks and also pamphlets, so his reputation spread around a great deal as a horror figure, as someone who was cruel. They often added this business of cruel, but just given the time period, tough time period, he took extreme measures. I don't agree with that, but that's the explanation that's usually given.
How do you think the Bram Stoker novel connected to Dracula? Because there's a whole other body of vampire folklore which we'll talk about.
Yeah.
But Bram Stoker used the name of Dracula, who you've researched, and he wasn't a vampire.
No, that's correct. What happened is Bram Stoker was impressed with a story called Carmilla, written by another Irish author, Sheridan Lefanu, which is a very bizarre story, actually, for that period, the Victorian period. It's a vampire story with kind of quasi-lesbian overtones, undertones, and things like that. Anyway, that story impressed Bram Stoker. He wanted to write a vampire story himself. He wasn't sure where he was going to set it. Then, in a book by Emily Gerard, he came across the whole chapter on Transylvanian superstitions. And there he found all the material for his vampire folklore, which is all authentic Transylvanian folklore. He did not make up anything. Garlic, all that business, the stake through the heart, he took that. And so he incorporated that. So often, and then he came across the legend of the Blood Countess, this Elizabeth Báthory. You remember in the novel, which you don't see in the movies, When Count Dracula first appears, he has a white mustache and white hair. He's an old man in the novel, unlike Frank Langella or Christopher Lee. They all look young. No. And then as he gets the blood treatments, his hair turns iron gray, darker, his cheeks turn ruddy, so it's the blood for cosmetic purposes to make you look younger and younger. That he got from this story she read about of Elizabeth Báthory. There were a couple of pages about her in this book of werewolves written by Sabine Baring Gould, who is most remembered for his rousing hymn, Onward Christian Soldiers. But anyway, he wrote a book on werewolves, too. And in that, he talked about this Elizabeth Báthory, who did these, butchered 650 girls in order to bathe and shower in their blood, because she had this notion that this kept her skin looking white and young, like the skin of the girls. So he took that whole business of the blood for rejuvenation purposes, and connected that all up with the folklore.
Now, you mentioned that all the folklore in Bram Stoker's book is accurate. Let's talk about that folklore and see what you found out about where it comes from. According to folklore, who becomes a vampire?
Well, according to the folklore, it's a little complicated. Someone who's a werewolf. A werewolf is someone, of course, who believes that he or she has become a wolf. A werewolf can become a vampire upon death. Anyone who's led a violent life. In the Christian civilization, children who die unbaptized. Then the seventh son of a seventh son is doomed. So that's the sort. Or, of course, the usual way is if a vampire infects you during life. And that occurs in a very specific way. It's not the way it is in the movies, you know, the bite on the neck and that sort of thing. The vampire must mix his or her blood with yours. You must drink the blood of the vampire so that your blood content changes. And so when you die, you will become united with that vampire in physical immortality.
Is there any pattern in the folklore to who the vampire is likely to use as his prey?
Definite pattern. That's a very important question, too, because vampires never, generally, attack strangers. They always attack members of the immediate family or those with whom they have been intimate in life. Only after they have taken care of the immediate family and friends and lovers and so on, do they branch out? Now, what goes on there is something psychologically very, very profound, I think. If someone you love dies, you don't want them dead, do you? If you really love them, you're sorry they're gone. You wish they were back with you. That's a very, very old tendency, you know. So there is this immediate wanting to have them back, you see, so that when, as it in their minds anyway, this person comes back from the dead, and the initial reaction is, wow, how great to see you, wonderful, you know, I'm so happy, you're not dead, you're back. Then, though, comes the fear. What is that creature going to be like who has gone through the experience of death? Will it be as human as we are, or will it be something different? And will it, of course, try to lure us into communion with it? And we know what that means. The only way you can join together with someone who has died is to become dead yourself, to go into the land of the dead, and that is the fear element. So that element, that's very strong in all those folklore stories, this attraction and then fear.
My guest is historian Raymond McNally. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with historian Raymond McNally, author of In Search of Dracula. There are also, in the movies and in the folklore, ways to repel a vampire
yes.
with a cross or with garlic. Yes. What's the significance of that?
First of all, let's take the oldest weapon is, of course, garlic. And garlic is a medicinal plant. Peasants use it to ward off disease. Anything that wards off disease is thought to have magical qualities and hence can ward off evil, such as werewolves, vampires, devils, and so on. So that's that element. Now, in a Christian civilization, they use it as the cross, because the cross is identified with the force of good and the vampire is identified with the force of evil. In other civilizations, they use other religious symbols. So that's the... It can only ward off the vampire, of course. These symbols are not good to destroy the vampire, just ward him or her off. Vampires, of course, can be male or female. I think that's rather important. They're one of the few night creatures capable of sex.
We talked a little bit about sexual imagery in the vampire folklore. There's a lot of religious imagery.
Oh, there certainly is.
In it as well.
Yes, it's a kind of antichrist figure, this vampire. Why? Well, first of all, it promises what all of us who love life want. Eternal life. But, of course, eternal life, we don't want that. And if we're going to get old, do we? Who wants that? Right? You want eternal life where you can remain physically young, and that is the promise, a great promise, physical immortality and to remain young and healthy. So there's that element. And the ceremony itself. You know, what are the two great taboos in modern civilization? One is we do not eat human blood anymore, and we do not eat human flesh. Those are taboo. They're basically antisocial behavior, right? Because if we were to allow that to go on, somebody's blood has to be drunk. Some one of us has blood has to be drunk, and some one of us has to give up our bodies to be eaten. However, in several major religions, this is done symbolically. You become one with the divinity by doing what is technically taboo. You drink the blood of the Savior, and you eat his flesh. You commit vampirism and werewolfism. And you join. It is communion. Well, this is a kind of unholy communion. You drink the blood of the vampire. You become one with the vampire. You acquire physical immortality at a great price. But, of course, immortality is usually, there's a price tag attached to it. So what I think the appeal of the story is, say, oh, wow, to live forever and to be young, wonderful. But then sour grapes.
Have you ever come across a story where you suspected there might be a real vampire in the classical undead sense?
Yes, one. When I was in Transylvania, I was at the foot of Castle Dracula, and I met a woman there named, her name was Tinka. She's one of the local villagers. And she told me that her father had died. This was 30 years before. She was telling me about something that happened 30 years before when her father died. And he was laid out to rest, and in that part of the world, as in other parts of the world, they keep the corpse in the house for 2-3 days before they put it in the ground. They noticed after 3 days that the skin was still pliable. Rigor mortis had not set in. And the cheeks bore a ruddy complexion. So the blood hadn't calcified. Signs of the vampire, the undead. So she told me she knew what had to be done, but she couldn't do it because, after all, it was her father's body, and she couldn't bring herself to do it. But the villagers went ahead and did it, and they did what is done in all the horror movies. They drove a wooden stake through the corpse, and then as an added insurance, they burned the body.
Are there still places like Transylvania where the legends are circulating and people still live in fear of it?
Oh, yes, definitely. I visited places. With members of the Institute of Folklore, I went up into the mountains with a tape recorder and we sat down with the peasants. And if you do it correctly, you have to talk about the crops. You know, you can't just walk up to peasants and say, hey, how about vampires or something? Peasants will lie to you, and peasants are not stupid. It's a wrong assumption on the part of many city people, you know, say, oh, these stupid peasants. They're not stupid. They're very clever oftentimes. You have to get their confidence. You talk about the peaches and the cows and all. And then you start asking them a little bit about, well, what do you know about the history of this place and so on? Have you ever heard of anything like a walking dead, an undead? You know, That's, and then they will open up once they know you're not making fun of them. And the belief is very much alive there.
Raymond McNally is the author of In Search of Dracula.
Welcome. Permit me to introduce myself. I am called Dracula. I am really the bebop vampire. I like the sun. I like the sun to shine. Drink. We must all drink. Everybody must drink. Today on the market we got instant blood for you to drink. I want you all to drink. Ah, that's it. That's good. That's good. Drink, drink, quench your thirst. Quench your thirst. Good. Children, you over there, drink your soup before it clots. Put the children to bed. Children, drink your blood and bite your mama goodnight. Bite your mama goodnight. Put two more marks on your mama's jugular vein. Go away. Go away for the moment. Let me do my work.
That's Philly Joe Jones recording Blues for Dracula. Tomorrow night, NBC premieres a new series called Sleepwalkers, the new entry in what the network calls its Saturday night trilogy lineup. TV critic David Bianculli takes a look at the show and at the entire fall season and doesn't find many thrills at all.
Ordinarily, I wouldn't waste my time or yours talking about a show like Sleepwalkers. The premise is good. It's about a bunch of scientists and psychologists who find a way to enter and interpret people's dreams and nightmares. But the two episodes I've seen aren't that good. The visuals are strong, but the scripts are weak. And since on radio you don't get the visuals, this is the impression you're left with.
They told me I only have a few weeks left. My own body's trying to kill me. Nobody can tell me why.
Michael Engelberg from the VA called me about you a month ago.
I gotta be honest with you, I don't have a clue as to what any of this has to do with my dreams.
Well, dreams can manifest themselves in the waking world as tangible physiological signs and symptoms. Now, we've seen cases where they've caused blindness, even paralysis.
So you're saying my dreams are killing me?
It's possible.
The only reason I'm spending time talking about Sleepwalkers is because of what it represents. As a new TV series, it's like a lot of other premiere shows this year. It's the kind of show that's a lot easier for a network to promote than for a viewer to watch. For example, NBC's promotions for Jenny were clever. The Jenny McCarthy sitcom itself was the polar opposite of clever. The other thing Sleepwalkers represents, besides its lack of excellence, is the final new card in this year's fall season deck. Sleepwalkers is the 37th and last new show to premiere as part of the network's fall 1997 schedule. A schedule that began rolling out back in August with a UPN sitcom called Good News. That three-month rollout doesn't help the networks generate any real momentum. In fact, by the time the last of the new fall series shows up tonight, five others already have been yanked from the schedules. UPN's Head Over Heels, NBC's Built to Last, and ABC's Time Cop are dead and gone, while NBC's The Tony Danza Show and Fox's 413 Hope Street are suspended and on hiatus. And this is in a year when the networks, by and large, are exhibiting more patience than usual. It used to be that all the fall shows would premiere head-to-head in an actual fall premiere week, the same time Detroit would advertise its latest model cars on TV. There was a lot of anticipation about new cars and new TV shows in the 60s. But in the 90s, Detroit isn't the only game in town, and neither are the broadcast networks. Both have had their market dominance erode over the years by outside interlopers. In the case of TV, the culprits are first-run syndication, and especially cable. And the networks don't help the status quo, either, by making shows that just aren't that exciting, or even that popular. If you take away NBC's must-see Thursday time slot hits, the awful Union Square and the funny Veronica's Closet, you're left with only two new series this year that have won their time slots more than once. ABC's Dharma and Greg, and, incredibly, the same network's terrible Teen Angel. And out of the 36 shows to premiere so far, only one has generated a lot of well-deserved conversational buzz, Ally McBeal on Fox, which hasn't done better than fourth place in its time slot since its premiere. But for my money, Ally McBeal is the only new fall series that you ought to be watching every week. And even in Las Vegas, 1 in 37 are pretty miserable odds.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Daily News. Coming up, we remember film director Sam Fuller, who died yesterday. This is Fresh Air. Film director Samuel Fuller died yesterday at the age of 86. Although he was a favorite of many filmmakers, including Martin Scorsese, Fuller's name was never that popularly known, maybe because most of his films were fairly low-budget, black-and-white action pictures from the 50s and 60s. He made westerns like I Shot Jesse James and 40 Guns, war movies like China Gate and Fixed Bayonets, and crime movies like Underworld USA and The Naked Kiss. He was praised as a primitive, a punk poet whose films have a hard-hitting, pulp journalist realism. Maybe some of his dialogue will give you a sense of that. In The Naked Kiss, a prostitute gone straight falls in love with the town benefactor and discovers he's a child molester.
Once before, a man's kiss tasted like that. He was put away in a psycho ward. Oh, I got the same taste the first time Grant kissed me. It was a, what we call a naked kiss. It was the sign of a pervert.
In Pickup on South Street, Richard Whitmark is a pickpocket who's just gotten out of jail. He picks the purse of a woman on a train, not realizing that she's running an errand for a spy, and what he's stolen is secret microfilm. The cops want to get it back.
We just want your cooperation, and the charges against you will be dropped. Isn't that right, Captain?
You know, I like to make this rap stick, but what he's got to do is more important.
Well, you boys are talking in the wrong corner. I'm just a guy keeping my hands in my own pockets.
If you refuse to cooperate, you'll be as guilty as the traitors that gave Stalin the Aba.
Are you waving the flag at me?
I know something in our side you should give.
And I know you pinched me three times, got me convicted three times, and made me a three-time loser. And I know you took an oath to put me away for life. Well, you're trying awful hard with all this patriotic eyewash, but get this. I didn't grift that film, and you can't prove I did. And if I said I did, you'd slap that fourth rap across my teeth no matter what promises you made.
Do you know what treason means?
Who cares?
Answer the man!
Is there a law now I gotta listen to lectures?
McGregor! Get him out of here! Get him out of this building!
Before Sam Fuller made movies, he was a crime reporter and wrote pulp novels. We called him at his home in Paris in 1991. He told me he had an affection for petty criminals. I asked him why.
About petty criminals, that word. Anytime I wanted to find out anything and all that, he'd be there at 4 o'clock, I'll find out. I'll get you the word. And if I'm not there before, they leave. They don't wait. And you can't give a petty criminal you and I, on this phone, we can kid each other saying, oh, I'm sorry about that date at the restaurant. I was running late and I couldn't get a cab and subway and I got late. You know, normally, the normal routine. A petty criminal said, then you should have thought of that before you went to see me. You should have gone 5 hours ahead of time. I'm doing you a favor, you're not doing me a favor. Anyway, I don't do business with you anymore. That's it. That's how they brief they are. If you're not interested enough, if you keep them waiting, they should. There's no reason to keep them waiting because they would never have that low type of a manner. Never. to keep you waiting.
So you're talking almost about a code.
It's a code. That's the only code they have is their word, W-O-R-D. They're very proud of that word. I did a picture about one of them, and that's why I got a kick out of Zanny, because he loved it, and the picture did very well. I told him I have an idea for a story, and it's about three, we call them the gutter boys. A gutter boy or a gutter girl is just somebody born in a gutter, lives in a gutter, and will die in a gutter, and then is swept right into the sewer. You'll never hear them again, never. They don't even get a number. If they ever find a body, they'll get a number and be buried in Pottersville. And I told them that I have a pickpocket. I told them I have a police informer who's a woman. And I have an idea of a girl who's so dumb. She can't be a whore. She can't be a mistress. But for $20 or $30 worth of dresses, she'll run errands for you. And he fell in love with those three people. He said, we never had any pictures done with anything like that now.
The movie you're talking about is Pick Up on South Street.
Yeah, but that's just an example of I had so many, and he went in love and fell in love with it because he gave the green light for these three people to be the stars of the picture.
When you cast an actor, especially in a crime movie, can you talk a little bit about what you're looking for in the face? And if there were certain characteristics that you really cast for in your films?
Oh, yeah, sure. Well, I really look for something that I can try to guess without knowing what he does. That's number one. The average criminal does not look like a criminal. The average criminal looks like Einstein with a mustache. I pick how I feel about a guy if I'm going to watch him for a couple of hours on a screen. And if I can believe he will do this and do that and keep a certain expression that he controls all the time. Then there's another type of an actor that only has one expression, and those are the dangerous guys in real life. That's like you go with a fellow on a date, and he has never changed his expression, and you think he's sick, he ate something. No, that's his expression is no expression. That's a dangerous man to fool around with in a romantic way, because you don't know what he's thinking. So if I can get anything that gets the audience a little uneasy, I like that.
Film director Sam Fuller recorded from his home in Paris in 1991. He died yesterday at the age of 86. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Today's archive show was produced by Roberta Shorrock. Our engineer was Audrey Bentham. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, retracing the steps of Lewis and Clark. We talk with Dayton Duncan, who with Ken Burns co-produced the new PBS special about Lewis and Clark. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.